Okay, good morning. Thank you for making time to come for this leases roundtable. My name is Prabhakar Kalavacherla, or usually called as PK. I am an ISB board member, and with me is Henry Rees, the associate director, also person who is very closely involved with the leases development from the staff side. So we thank you very much for making time to come here and share your comment letters. I just want to leave you with certain rules of the game such that we are all on the same page. What Henry and I thought we should do is that we should, first of all, let participants know, if you have not attended a previous roundtable, that this is not typically a discussion forum. You get a chance to comment on your aspect. We have four topics that we want to discuss in specific. In addition to that, we will have some opening comments and closing comments from the participants. But this is not per se a discussion forum, so you don't expect the myself or Henry to respond to every comment of yours. That's not the idea. I understand that this meeting is recorded for your information, so be aware that this is recorded. Participants, observers will be in observers only mode, so please respect that. Then what we will do is that in order to quickly do some introductions, we'll just go around the table and introduce the participants. Please tell your name and your organization that you're representing. And if you want to make a comment during the four issues that we are going to discuss, the agenda is in front of you. Please put up your name tag such that we will recognize who wants to speak about it. Try not to, and this is a request because we are on a tight schedule, try not to repeat what others said. If you have anything incremental, please say that. And but if it is so important you want to say something, we do allow people to jump the line by if you put your both your hands. So then we know that you are so desperate to speak, we will generally consider that. We do have a small tea break for 15 minutes. The way Henry and I are talking is that perhaps we will go see how it goes. Probably around 10:45 is the schedule in our mind to do the tea break for 15 minutes. But it could be 10:50 or it could be 10:40. But if you need to make some phone calls during that time, please be flexible that we will try. We'll try to stick to the schedule, but it all depends on you also to some extent. With that, let me just start with myself. I'm Prabhakar Kalavacherla, PK, ISB board member. Yuki.
Okay. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning, everyone. My name is Yuichi Sonoda. I'm Secretary General of Asian Shipowners Forum. I'm representing 15 National Shipowners Associations of Asia. Our main concern is the scope.
No, we'll go
okay.
The
Good morning. My name is Shinichi Yoshihara from Japanese Shipowners Association.
Good morning.
Hello. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Daniel Tan. I'm the Executive Director of the Singapore Shipping Association. Thank you.
Morning, everyone. I'm speaking from SMP, my own accounting firm. Thank you.
Hi, good morning, everyone. My name is Kian Hui. I'm a partner with BDO.
Good morning, Ranat Kemmer, representing ISCA, Institute of Singapore Chartered Accountants.
Good morning. I'm Seng Chun from ENY, representing EY and the Technical Partner of Singapore as well.
Good morning. Chris Peach, representing KPMG.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Swat Cheng, Technical Director of the Singapore Accounting Standards Council.
Morning. My name is Nagaraj Sivaram. I'm the Deputy Chairman of the Singapore Accounting Standards Council.
I'm Tan Sai Choi, representing Singapore Accounting Standards Council.
I'm Nicole Giles, Director of Technical Projects at the Australian Accounting Standards Board.
I'm Yoichi Kamiya, of ASBP.
My name is Pang Jin Fat from BOC Aviation, an aircraft leasing lessor.
Hi, good morning. My name is Ho Tak Chuen, representing Jurong Town Corporation in Singapore.
My name is Scott Moy Lee. I'm from PwC Singapore. I'm also the technical partner of PwC Singapore.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Sharik Barmaki. I'm representing Deloitte.
Thomas Egan, Standard Chartered Bank.
Con Yin Song, Grand Thornton, Singapore.
Welcome. Could you just introduce yourself? I know you just started. Apologies for that. Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Liang from China Ministry of Finance. Sorry for late.
No problem.
My name is Feng Tuijing, also from China Ministry of Finance.
My colleague.
I'm Henry Reeves of CK Fairs on the ISP staff.
Thank you very much. What we will do is that let us recap the topics that we want to speak today. We want to talk about the lessee and the lessor accounting models as topic one. Granted, that will take a substantial portion of it, maybe one third of our time today. Then we will speak about topic two, measurement. The third topic is scope. We definitely need to spend some time on scope, so we would like to make sure that we leave time for that. Then topic four is basically other aspects of the proposal, so we can talk about disclosures there, transition there, and any other topic of interest to you, we can definitely talk about it, but definitely let us try to touch on disclosures and transition and any other aspects you might have and any comments you have and the effective date should be and things of that nature. Then once we will spend 15 minutes, literally 15 minutes, going around the table for opening comments. We will again have a chance to do closing comments. So please restrict your comments to overall. Don't go too much into detail about each aspect of the four topics we are going to talk. But I think it will set a good mood if you just get opening comments. Stick to the opening comments. With that,
Can I just ask people to make sure that you try to talk into the microphone, because otherwise we won't capture your comments in the recording, which we really want to do. So just be careful to actually speak into the microphone. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, thanks, Henry. Please understand that this is very important to record it, because normally the ISB staff is on the phone or on the video. But you have to realize it's 1:30 a.m. in London. So the staff is really looking forward to the recorded comments. And so please pay attention to speaking into the mic. Okay, with that, let us open the forum. Anybody interested in making some opening comments? You started with saying something, so why don't you start?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am representing shipping industry, and we are concerned about topic three, scope of lease. We believe that operational arrangements such as time charters are service contracts, and that they should be excluded from the definition of a lease. I'll stop this at the moment. Thank you very much.
From Grant Thornton Ying.
Thank you, PK. Thank you for the opportunity for this roundtable. I'm going to make my opening comments short, like Yoichi. The ED makes, I think it will make accounting more complex, time-consuming, and difficult to operationalize. And once you have set the tone there, once accounting is difficult, there are knock-on effects. There are knock-on effects on the preparers, obviously the auditors and the regulators. So I don't think this is the right way to go. I'll set the tone also by saying that it's not a significant step up in terms of financial reporting from what we have in, now at the moment. It's great that the IASB and the FASB are sort of working together to improve lease accounting. For me, I would prefer an alternative, and that alternative is a control-based model that is consistent with the revenue recognition standard as well as the conceptual framework. In fact, the control-based model is sort of touched on actually in the ED for leases. So that's where I stand.
Thank you. Nagaraj,
yeah.
Please say your name so that the recordings will know who is speaking. Yeah. It's painful, but do
sure,
that.
Sure, not a problem. Yeah. Nagaraj from Singapore Accounting Standards Council. I mean, the Singapore Accounting Standards Council has written its comment letter, and we support the recognition of the liabilities on the balance sheet. And we think there are two types of leases, so the dual approach, there is some merit in it. However, there are many issues in the application of it and the complexity of it, and then we have comments on that which we'll elaborate on later.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Sing Chun from EY, representing EY. Overall, we support the recognition of leases on balance sheet, but we felt that it can be done in a more practical, conceptually more principled manner. In particular, the dual model of Type A and Type B, we see that as a conceptual compromise. And then from a cost-benefit perspective, we feel that the added complexity would result in costs far outweighing the benefits.
Yeah, Rana Klemmer, ISCA. Whilst we support the idea of bringing more leases on balance sheet, we have concerns that the current ED lacks principle. Some of the speakers already said that the dual model might be a compromise, and given where the board stands with the conceptual framework and some other projects, we think that it might be a better idea at this point in time to improve the existing IS 17 leasing standard rather than coming up with a completely new standard.
Sharik?
This is Sharik Ramaki from Deloitte. I think some of the comments have already been made. I just want to mention two other comments.
I don't think the mic is working. Sorry about that.
Yeah, okay. This is probably better. Start again. This is Sharik Barmaki from Deloitte. I think some of the comments have already been made around the complexity and cost relating to the dual approach. The two specific sort of comments I would just want to make at this stage, which is the definition of property as to what that entails, because we just think that in some cases there could be different consequences of a similar in nature type of underlying sort of assets, and it could result in some cases being type A and some being type B, and the consequences could be significant from that perspective. The other is just specifically in relation to type B, where the amortization is different because you have the same cost and the charges are different, which conceptually, again, I can understand the compromise, but conceptually, we're just struggling with that.
Nicole Giles, AAHB. Just as an opening comment, I wanted to note that we strongly support where the board is going in terms of trying to finalise the leasing proposals. We continue to support the right of use model and the overall principle of getting assets and liabilities onto the balance sheet. And although we have some concerns around the model as it's currently drafted, we do think it is incrementally a step in the right direction. So I will be expressing concerns around the dual approach as compared to what our preference would be, which would be a single approach. But even if the board continued with a dual approach, we would see that as preferable to the alternative of potentially stopping a project or going down the IAS 17 with additional disclosure paths. So we'd strongly encourage the board to continue the project and work towards finalisation.
Yuchi?
I'm Yuchi of SVJ.
we basically support Radu's model to regarding the receipt accounting, and we think that Radu's model has the potential to improve the current accounting standard ISO 17. But we think that it's unclear about whether it is benefits to users would outweigh the cost resulting from applying the right-of-use model to all leases. And we understand that a short-term lease is exception is provided in the ED, but more the broader exception may be necessary to make the proposal more operational. And that's our basic comment.
Thank you.
Thomas Egan, Standard Chartered Bank. We support the objective of this to improve financial reporting around leases. We believe there is a need to do that. We don't really believe that the model that we currently have in IS 17 is broken. It has served us well for decades. There is information, and I don't recall instances where audit failures or accounting failures or corporate failures were related to the failures of this leasing standard. The only one I really recall was Xerox, but that wasn't leases, that was revenue recognition on leases. So I question whether the standard is broken, okay? The whole legal and regulatory environment is built up around this standard. It's functioning quite well, and we're not really sure how it functions if these changes are made. Because fundamentally, while I agree with the liability aspects of the standard, I question the asset side of it. I question whether or not a lessor is actually selling an asset that it still has price risk on. I question if what is this asset anyway? It sounds like an intangible, but intangibles are scoped out of the standard, so it can't be an intangible. Yet I amortize it as I would an intangible. So there's many of these things that just are beginning to trouble me. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I just want to say something. However tempted I am to respond, the forum is not the right forum to do that. So just because I nod my head or smile, it doesn't mean, don't take it that I'm supporting you or against you. It's just my nature to smile all the time. But just be aware of that. Moi.
Okay. This is Moi Lee from PwC Singapore. We submitted our comment letter, and I just want to add on a point that's not been mentioned by the people in this group at the moment is on the classification of lease. I think we have some problems on the fact that we classify by the lease by the type of the asset. Conceptually, that's we don't think that is necessarily neutral and necessarily decision useful for our users. So that's the only point that I want to make incrementally.
Okay, good. Daniel? Yep.
Hi, this is Ken Hui from BDO. I think generally we support the ED effort to actually simplify the accounting and make sure that there's enough comparability. But at the end of the day, because now we are having a type A and type B approach, so it seems to go backtrack again, like giving people options and structuring opportunity. So I think our view is that there should be only one model that reflects the financing element of lease. I think that's generally our comment.
Now Daniel.
Thank you. Okay, Daniel Tan from Singapore Shipping Association. Firstly, I would like to thank this roundtable, or IHP, for inviting us to this roundtable meeting. Now, for your info, the Singapore Shipping Association, we represent more than 460 companies, companies from the very wide spectrum of the shipping industry. And we have actually submitted our comments to the board when it was initially sent out. And subsequently, I think in the revised draft, we have also provided our comments. Now, in our feedback, we have also tried to answer some of the questions that have been put up, particularly in relation to lessor and lessee accounting, classification leases, and also disclosure. Anyway, I think basically we find that the complexity of the proposal and the degree of judgment that will be required to interpret them, we fully find them very complex.
Now, I think the EU does not state in clear terms, for example, that service contracts are excluded from the proposed standard, and it also does not clearly define services. We also believe that in paragraph 19B is incorrect when it refers to the asset has been designed to function. In our view, this will be more accurately phrased as the right to use the asset has been designed. Now, as an example of the scope of deferring interpretations, while we are clear that time and voyage charters fall outside the definition of the lease in the proposed standard, there are entities both within and outside the industry which are interpreting this contract as containing both lease and non-lease elements and concluding that the lease elements need to be respond to the balance sheet. In the balance sheet. So thank you.
I'll go to Doug. Go ahead.
My name is Ho Tak Chuen, representing JTC. I think conceptually, I think we agree to with the concept of bringing the asset and liabilities onto the balance sheet. But the fact that we know actually a lot of analysts and financial institutions are really making the adjustment actually to in the analysis. So from that perspective, rather than having so many people doing individually compared to the preparer actually to prepare one set which facilitates that objective, I think it is more cost efficient. In terms of the dual model, I think we support it also because the attributes between, let's say, property and non-property are very different in terms of the economic life, okay, versus actually property and non-property is obvious. So in that regard, again, we support the dual model. However, having said that, there's a lot of judgment, okay, and complexity when it comes to implementation, especially when it comes to transitional arrangement, something which I will comment afterwards.
Thank you. Chris, you will get the final word on this opening comment.
Chris Peets, KPMG. So we are also supportive of the original objectives of the proposal, which were a single model for both lessors and lessees and certainly a less complex approach. So our concern is that we don't believe that these proposals are actually going to reduce the adjustments that users will actually be making. And so that's our concern. In addition, we obviously would like to see the lessor and lessee accounting to be consistent and also consistent with the other conceptual framework and other projects that are going on. And lastly, we are very concerned about the costs and the complexities of these proposals.
Thank you. Jess, I know I have seen... Do you want to say something? Or?
No.
Okay. Oh, the floor. I know I've been over the past 4 days, I must have met 80% of you or 90% of you in the room today. I don't think there is any user in terms of their vocation. Is that true, or is there any user in this panel today? I don't think so, but any user? Standard Chartered Bank, you
be a user in terms of lending.
So you are close to a user in that sense, rather than anything else. Okay, good. Why don't we spend 5 to 7 minutes? Thank you for those opening comments. Very helpful, very useful. Why don't we have... my colleague Henry to give a 5 to 7 minute update on the outreach done to date, especially the themes that we are hearing in terms of the outreach, especially from the analyst. Thanks.
Thanks, PK. One of the things that we've been doing whilst the exposure draft has been out for comment is really exploring the sort of the benefits and the costs of applying, or what they would be to apply these proposals. And so what we did first of all was really undertake fairly intensive outreach with a lot of users. And I think we've spoken to something like over 220 users in various different locations, really to sort of check, if you like, that what we're proposing here would be an improvement to the information that they get today. And then we've also been undertaking some fairly intensive outreach with some lessees, which is ongoing. The feedback from the users is obviously mixed, because users have different views how to account for leases and how they model leases. But overall, we do feel that we have broad support from the user community for the proposals and the exposure draft, particularly in terms of the balance sheet aspect of the proposals. Most users do believe that leases give rise to assets and debt-like obligations for the lessees. And actually, as the gentleman noted there, most users are already making adjustments to bring those leases onto the balance sheet. So what we hear from most users is agreement that effectively that following the accounting in the exposure draft would just make a much better starting point for their analysis than the type of adjustments that they're making today. So overall, they do find that aspect of the proposals a big improvement. Now, the users will continue to make adjustments because they do model leases in different ways. So that is true. They will continue to make adjustments. But effectively, they do see that this makes a better starting point. Now, the views, as I said, are mixed. And I think perhaps equity analysts do have slightly more mixed views than the credit analysts. The credit analysts are very strong supporters of the balance sheet proposals. Some of the equity analysts would perhaps have preferred the boards to actually capture the whole asset on the lessee's books, because that's what they're trying to model. Other equity analysts, some of them actually what they try to capture today are sort of this like an ongoing perpetual lease obligation. In other words, on the understanding that a retail outlet, if they have a three-year lease, is likely to need another lease at the end of that lease term, so they're trying to capture that ongoing perpetual commitment. In terms of the income statement aspect of the proposal, so basically the dual approach for lessee accounting, that's where the user views are perhaps more mixed. I think what we've noted is that the users who are following very much particular industries tend to like the information that they would get under these proposals. So, for example, the users who are looking at the airlines and other transportation companies tend to like the type A accounting and like the dual model. In contrast, the users who are looking at the retail industry and the hospitality industry very much support the type B, the single straight line lease expense approach, because that sort of works with how they model those businesses. So those users tend to sort of support the dual approach. The generalists perhaps have more concerns about the dual approach. There's undoubtedly some users who would prefer a single model rather than having the dual approach. So mixed views on the dual approach. In terms of just a few words about the preparer outreach. Clearly, we're learning a lot through these roundtables, and obviously we've got something like 600 comment letters to analyse. But what we've been doing is undertaking some workshops with lessees, fairly intensive workshops. The idea behind these workshops is because we go on site, because we meet more than just the accounting folk at these companies, we've been able to really dig into the proposals. And what we're really trying to get at is understand what are the particular aspects of the proposals that for the lessees cause the most sort of concerns about cost for them. And what we're hearing from the lessees, I think overall, from these workshops is that they do feel the proposals would be doable and could be done. But I think what a lot of them are calling for is further simplification. I think a lot of them feel that the proposals could and should be simplified. And just some of the aspects that the lessees are sort of noting that give rise particularly to concerns about complexity. First of all, many of them are commenting on the dual approach. That seems to give rise to additional complexity. And then it's aspects around determining the lease term. And
the significant economic incentives. I think many of them actually have seen that to be a lower threshold than actually what the board's intended. But then there's a lot of concern about the requirements to reassess the determination of the lease term and also the variable lease payment. So I feel a lot of the lessees are looking to the boards to try and simplify the proposals. I think also many are commenting on the scope in terms of, is there some way that the boards could perhaps just sort of focus more on the material, the significant leases? I think a lot of people feel that perhaps we're capturing leases that are perhaps not that significant to the financial statement. So I think a lot of the lessees are encouraging the boards to find a way of perhaps of simplifying the scope of the proposals. So that's just in a summary the feedback. I will just say that in terms of the user feedback, we have actually just posted to the website a more comprehensive and much better summary of it than I've just given you, but it's on our website. It's on the leases page. I think it went up at the end of last week. So if you're interested in reading a little bit more about what the users have told us, please go to our website. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Henry. As always, you're modest, but your summary is as good as the one on the website. Let's go to the topic one of the day. The topic that we want to talk about, lessee and lessor accounting models. Given my understanding from various outreach that we have done to date, I think lessee generates more passion than the lessor side. So let us start with the lessee and then go on to lessor. Let us do one thing. Given the fact that there is a little bit more passion around lessee, let us spend 40 minutes on lessee and maybe 25 minutes on lessor. We'll see how it goes, but you're not compelled to speak for all 40 minutes, but if you do, go ahead and let us spend that time. So any volunteers to start? Okay, we can start lessor then. Yes, Nagraj.
On the lessee accounting model, especially when it gets to type B, one of the approaches perhaps to reduce the cost and complexity issues would be if we could use the current operating lease accounting for the lessee side. I appreciate that certain liabilities will not get on the balance sheet, but hopefully these are minimal, especially if we did not get into distinguishing property leases differently, and we had the same rules for property leases or non-property leases. And then for the type B type of leases, we just had the current operating lease accounting. We would, of course, not have all the liabilities on balance sheet, but we would have captured most of the liabilities in the type A type of accounting.
I don't want to turn it into a debate, but can you elaborate, because I did read your comment letter, and I want to understand how does that proposal that you have improve our proposal, and how does that comply with the overall objective of putting all leases on the balance sheet? So can you please elaborate on that?
So yeah, you're right. For the type B leases, which are these shorter term leases, it does not get the liabilities on balance sheet. But most of the type the leases where we have, because for type A leases, we've reduced the threshold level to insignificant compared to what it is now. So given that, most of the equipment type leases and all of those will get onto the balance sheet, and that reflects the economics of the fact that they usually own these assets and you put those leases on balance sheet. But when it comes to short term property leases, say for 3 years or, for 3 year property leases, I know the liabilities won't get on balance sheet, but what it does, it reduces the cost and complexity for the lessees in a big way, and perhaps they'll have more acceptance of these proposals in that sense.
So if the property lease is 15 years, how does your proposal get them onto the balance sheet?
If the property lease
is 15 years. So that's why we said that you don't make the distinction between, you regard it, look at it in the context of the primary asset rather than, so if you have land and building, you look at it in the context of the building. And if you have the same rules for significant, you know, it is also followed the same rules as Taipei, then it would 15, if you say a building was 50, I suspect 15 over 50 would be more than insignificant. So in that sense, you would get that on. But it would then, we would then be on the same, you know, on a single model in that sense. And we would not have all the liabilities that you know, under the present proposals you get, but you would have most.
Okay, thank you. Well, this silence is good. Yes, Ian.
Thanks again, PK. While we can agree that the recognition, measurement, and presentation of expenses, you know, and cash flows arising from a lease should differ for different leases, I think to cut the line on model that differentiates leases based only on consumption, or based mainly only on consumption, is probably not appropriate. That is in line with my other comment on my preference for a control-based model. So maybe an updated definition of control, you know, to take care of this issue may help. As regards to Type B leases, if I'm not convinced that they're accounting for right of use of an asset as a tangible property is always correct. You know, I mean, you can apply your impairment, amortization, and revaluation provisions to an asset which is owned, to a tangible asset, but for Type B leases, I question whether it is right in the first place. I think just maybe alluding to what sort of Raj has said, you know, maybe the unit of account is not right. Maybe the unit of account should not be a right of asset, but the asset itself.
I see.
And that will sort of, you know, remove a lot of objections as to whether we can get stuff or the assets and liabilities on the balance sheet.
Just to add on to what Ying Tong and Raj mentioned earlier, the distinction of property and other assets, something that we struggle with. In particular, so that for property to get a Type A accounting, the threshold is either major part or substantially all. And for other assets to get a Type B is insignificant. So if you're going on the basis of consumption of assets as a conceptual basis of differentiating the two, there shouldn't be a difference in the threshold to get to either one of the dual model of accounting.
So which is similar to what Nagaraj is saying about, he doesn't want to have a distinction in terms of cut, both insignificant should work for both of them. But he further makes a suggestion about the how Type B can be quote unquote today's operating list. Yes, Chris.
I think just to add some more support to that, PK, I think it really does come back to what do you actually think you're accounting for? Is it the underlying asset or is it the right of use asset? And that really helps then decide whether you think you can actually have a dual model or not. If you really genuinely believe you have a right of use model, then I think it's very hard to justify a dual approach. If you believe you're accounting for the underlying asset, it then becomes an easier thing to accept that there's actually different types of assets that should be accounted for differently. And similarly to Grant Thornton, we think that if you're going to go down that route, we'd prefer that you start to look at a control-based model that would actually then be consistent with your revenue proposals and your consolidation proposals. But broadly speaking, you know, if we have a preference, we would more prefer that you had a single approach that was the right of use model, but that you actually provided more exemptions that actually make it easier to apply that. So we would look at trying to improve the short-term leases exemption so that that exemption is actually consistent with the lease term, so that it's not just a 12 months, it's whatever your lease term calculation actually is, and that you would also look at permitting anybody who was doing fair value through the P&L to be able to adopt accounting that was similar to the investment properties accounting.
Could you elaborate on your point on the short-term exemption, what you mean by there, Chris?
We were just trying to reduce some of the complexities by having different thresholds for different things. And so at the moment, the short-term leases exemption is different to how you would actually calculate the lease term. So we would actually say if you, the way you would calculate the lease term is going to be 12 months, then that's what the exemption should be, not just having a fixed 12-month period.
And you don't think that that would cause some more pressure on the risk of the sort of the structuring around the short-term leases? Because effectively, I think one of the reasons why the boards did what they did was, first of all, to keep the short-term lease exemption a very simple sort of exemption, but also it was conscious of the fact that it would put pressure on it, because effectively you could have a lease with a series of options that just potentially then just sort of, you know, falls out of the limelight, basically.
Certainly we'd accept that there's risks in that, but I think there's going to be risks in having that exemption in the first place. And so if that was something that enabled people to get there, get comfortable with the model, we could accept that.
And that's preferable to sort of perhaps just sort of extending the timeline on that simple short-term lease exemption, you know, so still keep it very simple, no options, but just have a slightly longer period than 12 months. I mean, some people have floated even going up, well, I've heard 5 years, but 3 years is one that people have said, I mean, it's fair, a lot of people have said that outside the sort of short-term car hire and things that perhaps people don't really think of as being leases, like hotel rooms and the like, they don't actually see many 12-month leases.
Yeah, 12 months, the maximum 12 months was put in only to avoid an obvious loophole. So that's why I was a little bit pushing you to explain your point. Thomas, could you?
Thomas Egan, Standard Chartered. I have one overriding fundamental concern, which is I'm still not convinced that putting everything on balance sheet solves a real problem. The financial information is there in the accounts. That's what's critical. And so I've never heard anybody disagree to the notion that this project will assist in that, in providing good quality information to users. And I haven't heard anybody not support that. So I think everybody's on the same page on that. But I'm not convinced that putting everything on balance sheet, be it in this project or any other project, really solves the problem. If the information is there, seemingly that's fine. And the fundamental concept shouldn't be whether it's on balance sheet or not, or it's whether that reflects the economic reality of the transaction. And for the lessee that's in a operating type lease currently, he's renting. This is the actual economic reality of that transaction. He cannot walk away without an obligation, but he can walk away. It's not his asset. He doesn't have the price risk. If he defaults, the asset reverts back to the owner, the lessor, and he is required to compensate him for the damages caused by his breach, not to pay him the full liabilities you would have in a financial instrument. So I'm not sure that this really reflects the economic reality in many instances. It reflects the economic reality if everything goes as planned. The other element of this is there is quite an uproar in the industry, in the leasing industry. And I dare say that if you move to this model, people will not sit still and continue to behave in the same manner they have been. They will look for opportunities to continue off-balance sheet treatment if that presents an advantage. The concern I have then is you go actually into an area where you probably have less information than you have now. So there is a danger that this actually will lead to behavior that's detrimental to users, not advantageous to users. Where I think a full disclosure type approach, an improved disclosure approach, that will advantage everybody. Thank you.
Yeah, we certainly heard that, but I think in the interest of time, I'm not going to ask you to repeat what you said, but your comment suggested that you have accepted the notion that there is a liability. I think your struggle is on the asset side.
And that's also whether that represents the entire amount. So is that fair to
say? I accept that there's a commitment, and I accept that that commitment...
It's a non-cancelable commitment.
Yes, right? And that commitment meets the definition of liability. But at the same time, take, for example, a inventory contract or like to purchase commodities. That's an executory contract. Those commodities may have been delivered to my warehouse. Until I accept title, they do not go on my balance sheet.
You know, the board struggled quite a bit on this, but one thing I want to say is that the asset is delivered here, the lessor has performed. That's where the I think the board felt that, yes, this is an executory contract, but one of the parties have already performed their end of the promise. That's why it gets a different notion than your inventory commitment and things like that.
Yes, but in many cases, the inventory is actually delivered to the purchaser's warehouse to utilize as and when they choose. Okay? Not in all cases. There are certain many different models. But the other thing is, yes, take, for example, a building or a vessel or an aircraft. Yes, it has been delivered. The person has put it into use. The fact of the matter is they have to continue to pay or it's taken back from them. So the title isn't really there. That party that has that ship or that aircraft, if they fail to make payment, they're going to lose it. And at the end of it, they are not, as an owner, they do not have price risk. They don't have residual value risk. So it's a bit of an odd asset. I mean, the obligation very much is there. It meets the definition of liability under the standard. It doesn't take the same form as, for example, a loan payable. It doesn't, you know, there's a mitigation here that isn't true in for example, a loan payable. So I see a distinction. The other thing is I've come to accept in accounting that everything doesn't fit into a nice box, okay? That you do have to make rules. And that's another concern I have here is this is a very rule-based standard now. I think IS 17 is a pretty principle-based standard. This is a very rule-based standard that avoids bright lines, which is going to make it difficult to apply. The word significant now in the accounting standards is becoming, well, significant. It's there all the time. But nobody can tell anybody what it means anymore. And that's the danger. I don't think you're going to get consistency of application on this standard across the industry very well at all. Thank you.
Thank you. Nicole?
Okay. I just wanted to add support for a single model. So we disagree. We disagree with the dual model as it's currently drafted. We do think there are many different types of lease arrangements, but we don't think the fundamental economics of the lease arrangements differ. So there may be different levels of consumption between leases, but we think that would be picked up in the differing finance charges. So we do think all leases have a finance element to that, albeit some of them will be a smaller finance element compared to others with a greater consumption. So we do support all assets and liabilities on balance sheet and the right of use model, but we're struggling with the dual approach and have some difficulties with that.
And it's fair to say that you prefer type A approach?
We would prefer the type A approach, yep. Okay. Along the lines of the previous ED.
Okay.
Thanks.
And?
I think we share most of the comments that's gone through. I think the single model approach will achieve its original objective of trying to simplify matter. As I mentioned early on, I mean, the objective of having this ED is to make sure that we don't run into inconsistency of having the same lease contract treat differently under different structuring opportunities. So I guess the question now is, having this new approach, are we giving lesser opportunity for people to do structuring? I think the answer may not be clear, because I think there's some opportunity for people who are creative enough to trick around and achieve whatever the accounting they need. So at the end of the day, then we are going back to the same phase where we have IS 17. So I guess the question is, what kind of robust model that we should achieve for type A to ensure that we capture whatever needs to be captured under our model and principle? Then, you know, there won't be any alternative at all. I think that's our view.
Yes.
Moyi from PwC Singapore. I mentioned about the concern we have between property and non-property differentiation in the lease classification. So what we've put in our comment actually would be that
considering the consumption model as well as the cost that's involved in implementing, we are recommending that we should incorporate the current IS 17 considerations in the classification of leases.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that by applying that, actually, you could get to so-called the property type of classification. And in doing that, actually, those things are really quite financing in nature. You will have the similar type of outcome for property and non-property type, like the ships, the aircraft, with a consistent answer. So that's our recommendation in trying to put to not a type A, type B, depending on the asset type, but you will come out with a consistent outcome based on the characteristics of the lease itself.
Sherry, can I'm going to call on Tuck, because here, if when I hear these opening comments and the discussion so far, Tuck, you are the probably supported the both the models. So can I call on you just so that in the interest of hearing all the viewpoints, to get your elaborate your viewpoints a little bit after Sherik has a chance to speak.
Right.
Yeah, Sherik, go ahead.
I think as Moili, this is Sherik from Deloitte, as Moili and Nicole mentioned, similar approaches we would propose from a Deloitte perspective. Again, you know, one model. And I'll just reiterate what I was saying earlier in my opening comment about just, concept of what is property. Specific examples around cell towers, and Moili mentioned ships and rail cars, etc. So similar, you know, and just because of underlying assets being different, you could get to a different classification. And I think that just leads potentially to a wrong answer. Hence, just classifying it based on underlying assets just gives us concern, and going back to, you know, one model based on substance as to what is financing.
And to some extent, that's what Chris was talking in her comment, whether it's the right of use of asset we are dealing with or we are dealing with the underlying property. So I think that's consistent with your comments. Tuck, I'm sorry that you didn't raise your lift your placard, but I'm asking you because you seem to Thomas is on one end that there's absolutely no asset on the balance sheet, but the others generally feel that there is an asset or a liability here. And what I heard so far is that, and what I read your comment letters is that that many people feel that there should be one model, and you seem to think differently. So can you elaborate on that?
Sure.
Also, can you, for the sake of everybody, just explain your business model a little bit?
Okay, I think in JTC, basically, we are in the industrial land so-called space. We buy land from the state, and we lease our actual land to our users. And most of the time, our leases are very long leases. For land, actually, it goes up to 60 years. Recently, I think we basically scale it back to about 30. But most of the time, we grant an option, so 30 plus 30. So the first important probably differentiator between, let's say, industrial land and perhaps a ship or even the aeroplanes or car is a long economic life, very long leases. Generally, I think if you put in the option, we're talking about 60 years. Okay. So in that regard, I think if you, let's say, compare a underlying asset, for which I think you talk about leases of 60, 90 years compared to 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, I think intuitively I say there must be a difference. Okay. So in that regard, actually, we believe that actually the having a dual model, property and non-property, makes sense. Okay. The only thing which probably I struggle with, perhaps going to the lessor part, is really to account for the residual asset. Again, because of the long leases, when the residual asset reverts back to us at the end of, let's say, 60 years, to measure in terms of the current economic so-called situation, to me, does not actually so-called make a lot of economic sense. Okay. So because of that, there's so much uncertainty what's going to happen, actually, so-called 60 years down the road.
in terms of the market situation, regulation, legislation, to really measure based on the current situation, to me, may not really represent the true economic so-called situation on the financial.
Thank you.
So those are my thoughts.
Yeah. But that's because of your situation, you support it. But as a model, what do you think? If you step back from your experience with your land and 60 years, but just looking from a much broader perspective, what do you think about that?
If I step away actually from my role as the CFO of JTC, I will probably support a single model.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Anybody else? Boy, you guys are ready for coffee break, I think. That's what you're all conspiring this way. If you don't have any comments on the lessee model, what we can do is that perhaps go to lessor and maybe Henry can teed up the lessor model for a few minutes, what we are trying to get, and again, spend some time around the lessor model, what do you think about it. And I know that our friends from the shipping industry are eagerly waiting for the scope, but to talk about the scope area and why they believe service and aspect of that. But let us spend some time on lessor, and maybe, Henry, if I can request you also to give a 1 or 2 minutes why boats got where they got to from the exposure draft, why we chose the dual model, and why we did that. That will be very helpful. And it adds to JTC's comment about the residual long life asset and all that stuff.
Okay, PK. In terms of the lessor accounting model, the thinking behind the lessor accounting model is to follow through really the thinking behind the consumption principle that gave rise to the dual approach that we've just been talking about in the lessee accounting model. And so I think what the boards are sort of thinking is that when there is more than insignificant consumption of the underlying asset, then the right way for the lessor to depict the transfer of the right of use asset from the lessor to the lessee is to effectively account for almost like a sale of a portion of the underlying asset, so the portion of the underlying asset that the lessee actually consumes. So that's why with the type A accounting, in other words, for the equipment and the vehicles, where there's more than insignificant consumption, essentially we have this sort of partial derecognition model, if you like. So the lessor derecognizes the underlying asset on its books, and in its place it records the receivable for the portion of the underlying asset that it's transferred to the lessee, and obviously records or continues to record the sort of the retained interest, which we describe as the residual asset. And so that means in terms of the income statement, the lessor may record some profit initially. That would be more for the manufactured dealer type lessors, not the pure financial lessors. And that just relates to the portion of the underlying asset that's been transferred to the lessee. And then records, obviously, interest income on the receivable and the accretion of the residual asset over the lease term. So that's the type A accounting. Now, with type B, the logic is since there's no significant consumption of the underlying asset, the lessor continues to recognize the whole of the underlying assets on its books and doesn't effectively do any derecognition of a part of that underlying asset, and recognizes rental income. And some of the thinking that got us there was just to sort of say, yes, you could build a model that was entirely consistent with the type A accounting for the lessee and do a partial derecognition model. But remember, with the lessor accounting, there's not only the lease contract to account for, there's the underlying asset to be accounted for. And when you start thinking about assets such as sort of shopping malls and big apartment blocks, it becomes very obvious very quickly that essentially doing a sort of partial derecognition model of that asset really wouldn't be that practical for a lessor to do. And there's also the question about the usefulness of the information. What's the right way of depicting the asset of the lessor, the actual underlying assets on their books? So that's, you know, some of the reasons how we got to the type A and type B. But I hope you can see that the sort of the consumption principle does effectively apply to the lessor model. So with that, I guess, the question that we particularly posed to you today on the lessor accounting model is question three. And essentially we're really asking, again, as we were with the lessee, do you think that the sort of the lessor model, the dual lessor model that we have, provides a sort of faithful depiction of the different types of leases that lessors enter into?
We have concerns with the lessor model in the sense that there's a lack of consistency between the lessee and the lessor. So if the lessee records a liability, then who records the receivable? And if you claim it's a principle-based standard, then we would think that it should be, there should be consistency. An added complexity would come into play when you look into groups where one of the group entities is the lessee and the other one is the lessor. How would you deal in such situations with
consolidation.
So we have a little bit concern of the principle behind it. We understand that it's difficult to apportion or proportion the sales type of a property lease, and talking about shopping malls and the like, that does cause issues. But if the principle is that there is consumption and you sold a part of the asset, that's not currently reflected in the type B model.
But just to push a little bit in your capacity as the Institute of Chartered Accountants, Singapore Chartered Accountants, how do you weigh the issue about the, if I have a tall building, Singapore has many of those tall buildings, and if I lease flat floor number 54, and only for 54, I lease it half of it because I'm a small-time chartered accountant and I cannot afford to have a full floor, so I only rent half. Then after 8 months, somebody else rents the other half. And, you know, you can go on with the multiple permutations. So how do you respond to the comment and also the residual value that that Tuck talked about in terms of 60 years, how do you estimate it? So what would be a factual way to deal with it? And I appreciate your concern about the principle, but how do you marry those things? And well, please remember, first exposure to second exposure draft, we did it only based on the feedback. Yes. So it will be very helpful if you can give us.
I think a reasonable approach, and Raj pointed it out, would be to look into the scoping a little bit closer and see what comes in and what comes out, and therefore deal with the problem at that stage rather than at the dual model stage. So, you know, a relatively short-term lease of a little bit of space in a 50-story building may not lead to a derecognition of a portion of the asset on the lessor's book, and could be seen more like a traditional rental agreement rather than a lease that creates the liability and the asset issue. So. I'm not
more than insignificant or significant. Well, so much of teasing us.
Well, that is one of the things to be worked out. But I don't think the benefits of having the dual model with the current inconsistency outweighs the cost of and the added complexity.
So you favor essentially a single model, but with a simplified scope.
Yeah.
Yuchi?
Thanks. Yuchi Kamiya from SBJ.
Can you speak to the mic, sir?
Okay.
We, as mentioned in our commentary, that we do not agree with the proposals for the line in between LESPA and LESPA-C, so type A and type B for LESPA accounting. This is because the LESPAs are exposed to the less friendly world associated with the residual asset. That's the difference. The economic position is quite different from the LESP side. So the in a comment writer, we proposed two types of alternatives for the LESP accounting, and this is somewhat similar to the line between the finance lease and operating lease under the IS-17, and this is because under the IS-17 the listed reward associated with the lady asset is considered, and so we about the symmetry between the listed accounting and listed accounting, we not necessarily think that that type of symmetrical accounting between the listed and listed is necessary, because because as mentioned before, the economic position between the listed and listed are different.
Yeah.
I think we have a discussion on the property. I guess because for investment property, okay, it's okay. Yeah. I guess the objective for having an investment property is dual. It's rental income as well as capital gain. So we will suggest that for investment property, we should bring this into the current standard, IAS 40, to further deliberate how this the income should work out. Maybe a simpler approach would be just a straight line recognition of the lease, unless this particular instance is closer to a sale, that means you are actually selling substantial portion of your building away in terms of the coin life. So I think the main thrust is that we should consider investment property separately in this context because of its nature of the returns that we're looking at, not just the rental income, but also future capital gain that we are achieving. Yeah. So a straight line approach will be...
So you're not in favor of the amendment to the IAS 40, is that what you're saying?
I think what we're saying is that the amendment to IAS 40 should take into effect into consideration how we should also, to take this investment property model into consideration, how we should we recognize income arising from a lesser perspective. Yep.
I thought you did. So I think we can take it offline.
Yeah,
Chris?
We certainly have concerns about a dual approach to lessor accounting based on consumption of the underlying asset. I guess we do support a dual model in the sense that we do think that the issues with type A can be solved through using an investment property fair value type approach. Because at the end of the day, if you're basically doing an investment property approach, the asset is at fair value. So whether or not the asset is a receivable or whether it's actually some form of PP&E doesn't actually really make that much of a difference. And on that basis, we do have some concerns with the type A accounting as well, because we think it's very complex and it will be very difficult to apply in practice. We are concerned about the fact that there's a residual asset accretion, which is not consistent with anything else that is not a financial asset. So even though we accept that that's actually what happens today in practice under IAS 17, we would say if you're really going to split out this residual asset and say that it's something different to a receivable, then you need to look at consistency with how we treat other types of assets. And I think you also have some issues there with deferred profit as well, because that really is also coming out of that residual asset accounting, and in addition the variable lease payments piece, even though we accept why you've included them, it makes the accounting incredibly complex.
I do take on board your comment about perhaps there is complexity in accounting of it. We had an alphabetical soup of letters to explain the equation there. But could you explain to me what would you do for the residual asset if you don't accrete it? Don't you think you get a lot of lumpiness in the sense that when you lease it subsequently, what do you do with that? It is not accreted to the assumed fair value.
So when you lease it again, you will have a big lump of it. Is that more informationally useful then? And also your comment, I'm interested to know your comment or your organization's comment about discounting on the residual asset, whether that should be accreted. What are the thoughts on that, sir?
I'm not sure we've fully fleshed out how to deal with the discounting issue, but I guess if you look at any other partial derecognition model, you don't end up with deferred profit. You basically end up keeping the piece that you've kept. If you're under an historical cost basis, you keep it at cost. You don't actually go out, inflate it, and then discount it back. And that's what generates the need then to accrete the interest. Now, we appreciate that from an economic position, the way that lessors actually look at their return is that they have actually included a return on that type of asset. But basically then really what you're saying is it's more like a receivable. So again, we would be encouraging more use of a fair value approach, which actually lets you eliminate some of those issues because you're actually in more of a financial model.
But if there's a fair value, then the deferred profit can be recognized immediately. So that is another complexity you have to think about. So I don't know whether saying that don't accrete the residual value is a easy cut answer. I just say that I respect your comment, but I'm just pushing back a little bit and saying I don't know whether I'm fully on board to understand the things, because when you do the equation, the residual value comes out and there is a deferred profit. Otherwise, what do you do with that number? You can't recognize it. Otherwise, people will start playing games. They give for 1 year lease and recognize a profit on an asset of 55 years. So you can get to all kinds of things. I can give up my job and start that practice.
I mean, that was what the boards were trying to balance, was the fact, you know, with the first DD, there was no accretion of the residual. And, of course, as you said, the lessor is charging a return. They require a return on their investment in the residual. And so, it was the balance between then. I think the boards are very uncomfortable about recognising profit on the retained piece of the asset. So that's essentially how we ended up trying to balance those two requirements there, trying to give a better depiction of actually how the lessors are pricing their leases versus the uncomfortableness, if you like, about recognising a significant amount of profit on a short-term lease of equipment. I was just sort of picking up on Yoik's comments. I mean, it is interesting. We're hearing very mixed views about the symmetry arguments, and some people are looking for strong symmetry between the lessee and the lessor model, in the sense of symmetry, in the sense of if the lessee is recording a lease liability, then the lessor should be recording a receivable. Others, though, have similar view to what the ASBJ argue, which is sort of saying the information needs are different, and certainly a lot of users don't strongly see a need to have the sort of symmetry between the lessee and the lessor model. So very sort of mixed views about how the board should proceed with lessor accounting.
This is Sachin from Singapore Accounting Standards Council. Although we kind of earlier agreed or proposed that the classification principle should be applied consistently to both property and non-property, we kind of can appreciate and agree with the IFB rationale in terms of the proposal for lessors of property leases. I think, frankly, on the basis that if the lessors were to apply type A accounting to each and every distinct portion of a building, we do not believe that that would produce decision useful information. And we also acknowledge the practical challenges in having to do that, which is why whilst we think that the principle should be applied consistently, we would recommend that a scope exception be provided for lessors of properties. So it's kind of applying an approach that is fairly similar to the proposals in the 2013 ED. except that we believe the lease term should be assessed with reference to the total economic life of the primary asset rather than the remaining economic life of the building.
I just want to make a comment.
Could you just say your name?
My name is Pang. I'm from DOC Aviation. I just want to make a comment on this dual approach. The board recognizes the dual approach, and that applies mainly for property. But I just want to mention that the economic reality of a financial lease and operating lease are totally different. And I don't see why there should be symmetry between, let's say, accounting, which doesn't take the ownership risk, then for the lessor who does take the ownership risk. No doubt the lessor has to perform at the outset, but it's on the assumption that the lessee continue to pay his lease renter. Now, in my industry, it's very difficult for me to write leases from 3 to 12 years, or even up to 15 years. And, of course, some of them could be significant part. But in my industry, default is very common. I believe that this standard, or proposed standard, adds more complexity. It is very common for me to take asset back, and the asset remains unplaced. What do I do with that asset? Does it go onto my balance sheet while I try to fix the asset and place it 1 year time, and then I do a de-recognition model again? That creates a lot of complexity. And by the fact that you want the disclosure item there, we are just doing double work for the analyst. And the real effect for lessor is always residual value. And your residual value in your model is just a plug-in balancing figure. So in any position, even if this proposed standard is accepted, analyst will still come to me for my asset value. Because that's where the critical component of operating lessor is. We have value in the asset, not in the lease receivable. Sure, the lease receivable reduced my asset risk, but I'm looking at the asset as my main contribution of profit. Thank you.
So please elaborate. I didn't quite catch what you said, the analyst coming back and still asking you about residual value. Could you please elaborate that?
When the analyst look at my asset, they want all my total value of all my assets in the books. So if those assets are not going to be reflected, except for the future residual value, they will continue to ask for valuation for those assets.
So just to understand, since you lease aircraft, and you're saying that right now you have many of your aircraft on your balance sheet.
All of my aircraft are on balance sheet.
That's the problem, right? David Tweedy didn't want that to happen on the lessor side. So since all your aircraft are on the balance sheet, so you're saying that if you move to the proposals in the exposure draft, you will have them as a type A. Therefore, you're saying that even though you put a receivable and residual, your analyst will come back and ask you what is the total value of the aircraft?
Right, they will.
Okay.
In my
is that because, why is that? Could you explain?
Because in my pricing model, every lessor has assumed what they're going to sell. Because they take ownership risk.
Okay.
Right? They will have a different assumption as to their residual value. Some will go on their own model, some will just take appraised value. Everybody has different value. So that's how it works, because our model is essentially a residual value. Where is my residual value at the end of the lease or even before the end of the lease?
Could you help me with one thing? If you keep the asset on the balance sheet, since you are not going to do the asset at fair value right now, you
won't. FIS 36, right? You do impairment test as well.
You do impairment, but you don't mark the. Let's say the aircraft industry is doing well, which I understand it's doing right now. So you don't mark up your assets to do. They're at historical cost, right?
We don't mark our assets.
So don't you think that at the time of lease, if you put a residual asset, that is more reflective of the current fair value or accretion to the fair value at the end of the lease, that is a more current information than what you have as an aircraft at a historical cost?
But your residual value is dependent on your receivable.
Yeah.
Right.
And the type, and also the period of lease. Yeah.
Correct. So, how does this show?
Is it the deferred profit piece of the residual asset that is impairing the quality of the information about the residual asset?
As PJ said, it depends on my lease term.
Yeah.
And the lessee. Okay. It depends on the lease term and lessee as well. So when you present value the when you recognize, you just present value all the receivable, and the balance will be your residual value.
Yes. The part of this is that the leasing of, for example, aircraft is quite a complex business.
Yep.
And you don't enter into a single lease for the – that would be a financing lease.
Yep.
So you go through a stage of leases during the life of that asset.
Yep.
And that makes it very complicated.
Yep.
I mean, you can't look at it – looking at a point-in-time fair value would be very misleading, because you're going to get – You're going to get a belief in a down market that this thing is completely impaired when you realize that that cycle can't continue. Same in the shipping industry. So it's a very complex business, and it's very difficult to create these residual values and find that they mean something over a period of time.
Yeah, I appreciate the comment about the complexity, but I push back in saying that if the historical cost is a much superior information in that situation. Rather than, I appreciate fair value is a point in time, like anything else, but historical cost is much less informative in my mind. Again, we can talk about it separately, but I don't know whether that means it's complex, so we'll revert to historical cost may not be incremental approach.
It's the value you paid for the asset that you're going to consume consume it in a manner of actually leasing it to somebody else to consume. It does represent that input factor. Now, what happens now is you have to figure out what is going to be your inflow from utilizing that asset. That's very difficult to predict in the future. And so you look at a time horizon, and you are required, though, as mentioned, you have to apply IAS 36, so you do have to look at that issue. You do have to look towards what that residual value would be, but I don't think you're going all the way to saying we should be fair valuing these assets. I think what you're suggesting is that information more geared towards that kind of economic reality that reflects a change from the point where you purchased it would be superior. I can't really argue with that.
Okay. I was a little worried. I don't know who raised the placard first, but if it's Sharik, so go for it.
So this is Sharik here from Deloitte. I think we've talked about the type A symmetry for lessors and lessees, and I can see the logic. But just hearing the discussion just now, I can expand on the complexity. So I can see the preparers having to do a lot of complicated sort of accounting in terms of recognizing a receivable and a profit and the residual and the deferred profit and then the accretion over the lifetime. And I'm a practicing accountant, practicing auditor, and I'm just thinking I go in with a company which has got lots of these, as a lessor, lots of these leases, and you can just envision the kind of complexity that will arise. And I dare to mention that we already have lots of complexities from an auditing perspective. And you add this to the cauldron, I think that just creates lots of sort of issues from a practical perspective. So that's just one point from as a practicing auditor. The second is what I said earlier about just the definition of property, and again, economically similar transactions potentially having different accounting treatment, because we have two types, and you could have potentially similar transactions. If you become type B, then that remains on the balance sheet, et cetera. So that's just a concern from an overall perspective.
Yeah. If nobody else has the desire to speak on this subject, we will have Kok Moyi as the final word on this, and then I'll summarize for a minute, then we can go for a break.
This is Moyi from PwC. I echo the complexity. I'm not going to add on comments on that.
Just like to reiterate what we talk about, not distinguishing property, non-property, using IS 17 for all types of leases. We think that if we use that for lessor accounting as well, we probably get round to more or less the same accounting that we have today, right? And we think that that actually probably would reflect more of the economics. It could help people in the aircraft industry or the shipping industry, in the sense that if we think about it conceptually, you get a receivable or and a residue asset, your type A type of lease accounting, if you really have sold the asset in substance, right? So if we apply IS 17 kind of lease classification right now, you probably will get to those answers, and those answers would be actually in substance reflect the economics of it.
Okay. Just to say that some of the user feedback on this, I think, probably would resonate with many of the comments that have been made this morning, which is that generally I think users are trying to get more insight into the residual risks and the receivables that lessors have with current operating leases today. However, a lot of users do have concerns with the type A accounting and some of the volatility that arises in the pattern of profit recognition, and particularly when you lay in other services that are being provided. And so I think some of those users are looking for more information about residual value risk, but prefer the current lessor model today, which sort of keeps more underlying assets on the book. So that's some of the feedback that we've been hearing.
I think to understand, and please correct me if I'm saying anything that doesn't resonate with what you think you have said. I think there is some amount of convergence in this area from the participants today, in the sense that A is that some people have said that they don't agree on a principles basis to have not to have a symmetry, and we heard that they prefer a symmetry model. And we heard, I think, quite a bit of commentary on the complexity around type A, in the sense that the residual value calculation that Chris touched on it, and Tim touched on it, and also I think we also heard the comment that despite doing the type A, which they believe they will fall into the aircraft leasing industry, they feel that the users will come back and still ask them to give the whole asset information, and and so they feel that this will add to that. Is that fair, Tim? What I said? And I think Moi and others have talked about the IAS 17 cut for both for the lessee and the lessor. So, and to way to alleviate the concern, and also at the same time maintain a dual model but with a different cut. Is that fair assessment, or any other additions? Did I miss something? Good. So let us take a 15-minute break, and we'll come back and talk about measurement. I think that will be more fun in terms of discussion. Then we will go on. Thank you.